American elephant, he submitted, was a totally new animal with which anatomists were unacquainted. It was, he decided, carnivorous, hence its scary-looking teeth. He dubbed the beast the American Incognitum. France's leading naturalist, Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, added yet another twist to the debate. He argued that the remains in question represented not one or two, but three separate animals, an elephant, a hippopotamus, and a third as yet unknown species. With great trepidation, Buffon allowed that this last species, the largest of them all, seemed to have disappeared. It was, he proposed, the only land animal ever to have done so. In 1781, Thomas Jefferson was drawn into the controversy. In his Notes on the State of Virginia, written just after he left the state's governorship, Jefferson concocted his own version of the incognitum. The animal was, he maintained with Buffon, the largest of all beasts, 5 or 6 times the cubic volume of the elephant. This would disprove the theory, popular in Europe at the time, that the animals of the New World were smaller and more degenerate than those of the Old. The creature, Jefferson agreed with Hunter, was probably carnivorous. But it was still out there somewhere. If it could not be found in Virginia, it was roaming those parts of the continent that remain in their aboriginal state, unexplored and undisturbed. When, as president, he dispatched Meriwether Lewis and William Clark to the Northwest, Jefferson hoped that they would come upon live incognita roaming its forests. Such is the economy of nature, he wrote, that no instance can be produced of her having permitted any one race of her animals to become extinct, of her having formed any link in her great work so weak as to be broken. Cuvier arrived in Paris in early 1795, half a century after the remains from the Ohio Valley had reached the city. He was 25 years old, with wide-set gray eyes, a prominent nose, and a temperament one friend compared to the exterior of the earth. Generally cool, but capable of violent tremors and eruptions. Cuvier had grown up in a small town on the Swiss border and had few contacts in the capital. Nevertheless, he had managed to secure a prestigious position there, thanks to the passing of the Ancien Régime on the one hand and his own sublime self-regard on the other. An older colleague would later describe him as popping up in Paris like a mushroom. Cuvier's job at Paris's Museum of Natural History, the democratic successor to the King's Cabinet, was, officially, to teach. But in his spare time, he delved into the museum's collection. He spent long hours studying the bones that Langeois had sent to Louis XV, comparing them with other specimens. On April 4th, 1796, or, according to the revolutionary calendar in use at the time, 15 Germinal Year 4, he presented the results of his research at a public lecture. Cuvier began by discussing elephants. Europeans had known for a long time that there were elephants in Africa, which were considered dangerous, and elephants that resided in Asia, which were said to be more docile. Still, elephants were regarded as elephants, much as dogs were dogs, some gentle and others ferocious. On the basis of his examination of the elephant remains at the museum, including one particularly well-preserved skull from Ceylon and another from the Cape of Good Hope, Cuvier had recognized, correctly of course, that the two belonged to separate species. It is clear that the elephant from Ceylon differs more from that of Africa than the horse from the ass or the goat from the sheep, he declared. Among the animal's many distinguishing characteristics were their teeth. The elephant from Ceylon had molars with wavy ridges on the surface, like festooned ribbons, while the elephant from the Cape of Good Hope had teeth with ridges arranged in the shape of diamonds. Looking at live animals would not have revealed this difference, as who would have the temerity to peer down an elephant's throat? It is to anatomy alone that zoology owes this interesting discovery, Cuvier declared. Having successfully, as it were, sliced the elephant in two, Cuvier continued with his dissection. The accepted theory about the giant bones from Russia, Cuvier concluded after scrupulous examination of the evidence, was wrong. The teeth and jaws from Siberia do not exactly resemble those of an elephant. They belong to another species entirely. As for the teeth of the animal from Ohio, well, a single glance was sufficient to see that they differ still further. What has become of these two enormous animals, of which one no longer finds any living traces? He asked. The question, in Cuvier's formulation, answered itself. They were espèces perdues, or lost species. Already, Cuvier had doubled the number of extinct vertebrates from, possibly, 1 to 2. He was just getting going. A few months earlier, Cuvier had received sketches of a skeleton that had been discovered on the bank of the Rio Luján, west of Buenos Aires. The skeleton, 12 feet long and 6 feet high, had been shipped to Madrid, where it had been painstakingly reassembled. Working from the sketches, Cuvier had identified its owner, once again correctly, as some sort of outlandishly oversized sloth. He named it Megatherium, meaning giant beast. Though he had never traveled to Argentina, or for that matter anywhere farther than Germany, Cuvier was convinced that Megatherium was no longer to be found lumbering along the rivers of South America. It, too, had disappeared. The same was true of the so-called Maastricht animal, whose remains, an enormous pointy jaw studded with shark-like teeth, had been found in a Dutch quarry. The Maastricht fossil had recently been seized by the French, who occupied the Netherlands in 1795. And if there were 4 extinct species, Cuvier declared, there must be others. The proposal was a daring one to make, given the available evidence. On the basis of a few scattered bones, Cuvier had conceived of a whole new way of looking at life. Species died out. This was not an isolated, but a widespread phenomenon. All these facts, consistent among themselves, and not opposed by any report, seem to me to prove the existence of a world previous to ours, Cuvier said. But what was this primitive Earth? And what revolution was able to wipe it out? Since Cuvier's day, the Museum of Natural History has grown into a sprawling institution with outposts all over France. Its main buildings, though, still occupy the site of the old royal gardens in the 5th arrondissement. Cuvier didn't just work at the museum. For most of his adulthood, he also lived on the grounds, in a large stucco house that has since been converted into office space. Next to the house, there's now a restaurant, and next to that a menagerie, where, on the day that I visited, some wallabies were sunning themselves on the grass. Across the gardens, there's a large hall that houses the museum's paleontology collection. Pascal Tassy is a director at the museum who specializes in proboscideans, the group that includes elephants and their lost cousins, mammoths, mastodons, and gomphotheres, to name just a few. I went to visit him because he'd promised to take me to see the very bones Cuvier had handled. I found Tassy in his dimly lit office, in the basement under the paleontology hall, sitting amid a mortuary's worth of old skulls. The walls of the office were decorated with covers from old Tintin comic books. Tassy told me he'd decided to become a paleontologist when he was 7, after reading a Tintin adventure about a dig. We chatted about proboscideans for a while. They're a fascinating group, he told me. For instance, the trunk, which is a change of anatomy in the facial area that is truly extraordinary, it evolved separately 5 times. 2 times, yes, that's surprising. But it happened 5 times independently. We are forced to accept this by looking at the fossils. So far, Tassi said, some 170 proboscidean species have been identified, going back some 55 million years. And this is far from complete, I am sure. We headed upstairs, into an annex attached to the back of the paleontology hall, like a caboose. Tassi unlocked a small room, crowded with metal cabinets. Just inside the door, partially wrapped in plastic, stood what resembled a hairy umbrella stand. This, Tassi explained, was the leg of a woolly mammoth, which had been found, frozen and desiccated, on an island off northern Siberia. When I looked at it more closely, I could see that the skin of the leg had been stitched together, like a moccasin. The hair was a very dark brown, and seemed, even after more than 10,000 years, to be almost perfectly preserved. Tassi opened up one of the metal cabinets and placed the contents on a wooden table. These were the teeth that Longjoy had schlepped down the Ohio River. They were huge and knobby and blackened. This is the Mona Lisa of paleontology, Tassi said, pointing to the largest of the group. The beginning of everything. It's incredible because Cuvier himself made the drawing of this tooth. So he looked at it very carefully. Tassi pointed out to me the original catalog numbers, which had been painted on the teeth in the 18th century and were now so faded they could barely be made out. I picked up the largest tooth in both hands. It was indeed a remarkable object. It was around 8 inches long and 4 across, about the size of a brick and nearly as heavy. The cusps, 4 sets, were pointy, and the enamel was still largely intact. The roots, as thick as ropes, formed a solid mass the color of mahogany. From an evolutionary perspective, there's actually nothing strange about a mastodon's molars. Mastodon teeth, like most other mammalian teeth, are composed of a core of dentin surrounded by a layer of harder but more brittle enamel. About 30 million years ago, the proboscidean line that would lead to mastodons split off from the line that would lead to mammoths and elephants. The latter would eventually evolve its more sophisticated teeth, which are made up of enamel-covered plates that have been fused into a shape a bit like a bread loaf. This arrangement is a lot tougher, and it allowed mammoths, and still allows elephants, to consume an unusually abrasive diet. Mastodons, meanwhile, retained their relatively primitive molars, as did humans, and just kept chomping away. Of course, as Tassi pointed out to me, the evolutionary perspective is precisely what Cuvier lacked, which in some ways makes his achievements that much more impressive. Sure, he made errors, Tassi said, but his technical works, most of them are splendid. He was a real fantastic anatomist. After we had examined the teeth for a while longer, Tassi took me up to the paleontology hall. Just beyond the entrance, the giant femur sent to Paris by Longjoy was displayed, mounted on a pedestal. It was as wide around as a fence post. French schoolchildren were streaming past us, yelling excitedly. Tassi had a large ring of keys, which he used to open up various drawers underneath the glass display cases. He showed me a mammoth tooth that had been examined by Cuvier, and bits of various other extinct species that Cuvier had been the first to identify. Then he took me to look at the Maastricht animal, still today one of the world's most famous fossils. Though the Netherlands has repeatedly asked for it back, the French have held onto it for more than 200 years. In the 18th century, the Maastricht fossil was thought by some to belong to a strange crocodile, and by others to be from a snaggle-toothed whale. Cuvier would eventually attribute it, yet again correctly, to a marine reptile. The creature later would be dubbed a mosasaur. Around lunchtime, I walked Tassie back to his office. Then I wandered through the gardens to the restaurant next to Cuvier's old house. Because it seemed like the thing to do, I ordered the menu Cuvier, your choice of entree plus dessert. As I was working my way through the second course, a very tasty cream-filled tart, I began to feel uncomfortably full. I was reminded of a description I had read of the anatomist's anatomy. During the Revolution, Cuvier was thin. In the years he lived on the museum grounds, he grew stouter and stouter, until, toward the end of his life, he became enormously fat. With his lecture on the species of elephants, both living and fossil, Cuvier had succeeded in establishing extinction as a fact. But his most extravagant assertion, that there had existed a whole lost world filled with lost species, remained just that. If there had indeed been such a world, traces of other extinct animals ought to be findable. So Cuvier set out to find them. As it happens, Paris in the 1790s was a fine place to be a paleontologist. The hills to the north of the city were riddled with quarries that were actively producing gypsum, the main ingredient of plaster of Paris. The capital grew so haphazardly over so many mines that by Cuvier's day, cave-ins were a major hazard. Not infrequently, miners came upon weird bones, which were prized by collectors, even though they had no real idea what they were collecting. With the help of one such enthusiast, Cuvier had soon assembled the pieces of another extinct animal, which he called l'animal moyen de Montmartre, the medium-sized animal from Montmartre. All the while, Cuvier was soliciting specimens from other naturalists in other parts of Europe. Owing to the reputation the French had earned for seizing objects of value, few collectors would send along actual fossils. But detailed drawings began to arrive from, among other places, Hamburg, Stuttgart, Leiden, and Bologna. I should say that I have been supported with the most ardent enthusiasm by all Frenchmen and foreigners who cultivate or love the sciences, Cuvier wrote appreciatively. By 1800, which is to say 4 years after the elephant paper, Cuvier's fossil zoo had expanded to include 23 species he deemed to be extinct. These included a pygmy hippopotamus, whose remains he discovered in a storeroom at the Paris Museum, an elk with enormous antlers, whose bones had been found in Ireland, and a large bear, what would now be known as a cave bear, from Germany. The Montmartre animal had, by this point, divided or multiplied into 6 separate species. Even today, little is known about these species, except that they were ungulates and lived some 30 million years ago. If so many lost species have been restored in so little time, how many must be supposed to exist still in the depths of the earth? Cuvier asked. Cuvier had a showman's flair, and long before the museum employed public relations professionals, knew how to grab attention. He was a man who could have been a star on television today, is how Tassi put it to me. At one point, the Parisian gypsum mines yielded a fossil of a rabbit-sized creature with a narrow body and a squarish head. Cuvier concluded, based on the shape of its teeth, that the fossil belonged to a marsupial. This was a bold claim, as there were no known marsupials in the old world. To heighten the drama, Cuvier announced he would put his identification to a public test. Marsupials have a distinctive pair of bones, now known as epipubic bones, that extend from their pelvis. Though these bones were not visible in the fossil as it was presented to him, Cuvier predicted that if he scratched around, the missing bones would be revealed. He invited Paris's scientific elite to gather and watch as he picked away at the fossil with a fine needle. Voila! The bones appeared. A cast of the marsupial fossil is on display in Paris in the Paleontology Hall, but the original is deemed too valuable to be exhibited and so is kept in a special vault. Cuvier staged a similar bit of paleontological performance art during a trip to the Netherlands. In a museum in Haarlem, he examined a specimen that consisted of a large, half-moon-shaped skull attached to part of a spinal column. The 3-foot-long fossil had been discovered nearly a century earlier and had been attributed, rather curiously, given the shape of the head, to a human. It had even been assigned a scientific name, Homo diluvitestis, or man who was witness to the flood. To rebut this identification, Cuvier first got hold of an ordinary salamander skeleton. Then, with the approval of the Haarlem Museum's director, he began chipping away at the rock around the deluge man's spine. When he uncovered the fossil animal's forelimbs, they were, just as he had predicted, shaped like a salamander's. The creature was not an antediluvian human, but something far weirder, a giant amphibian. The more extinct species Cuvier turned up, the more the nature of the beasts seemed to change. Cave bears, giant sloths, even giant salamanders, all these bore some relationship to species still alive. But what to make of a bizarre fossil that had been found in a limestone formation in Bavaria? Cuvier received an engraving of this fossil from one of his many correspondents. It showed a tangle of bones, including what looked to be weirdly long arms, skinny fingers, and a narrow beak. The first naturalist to examine it had speculated that its owner had been a sea animal and had used its elongated arms as paddles. Cuvier, on the basis of the engraving, determined, shockingly, that the animal was actually a flying reptile. He called it a pterodactyl, meaning wing-fingered. Cuvier's discovery of extinction, of a world previous to ours, was a sensational event, and news of it soon spread across the Atlantic. When a nearly complete giant skeleton was unearthed by some farmhands in Newburgh, New York, it was recognized as a find of great significance. Thomas Jefferson, at this point the vice president, made several attempts to get his hands on the bones. He failed. But his even more persistent friend, the artist Charles Wilson Peale, who'd recently established the nation's first natural history museum in Philadelphia, succeeded. Peale, perhaps an even more accomplished showman than Cuvier, spent months fitting together the bones he'd acquired from Newburgh, fashioning the missing pieces out of wood and papier-mâché. He presented the skeleton to the public on Christmas Eve, 1801. To publicize the exhibition, Peale had his black servant, Moses Williams, don an Indian headdress and ride through the streets of Philadelphia on a white horse. The reconstructed beast stood 11 feet high at the shoulder and 17 feet long from tusks to tail, a somewhat exaggerated size. Visitors were charged 50 cents, quite a considerable sum at the time for a viewing. The creature, an American mastodon, still lacked an agreed-upon name and was variously referred to as an incognitum, an Ohio animal, and, most confusingly of all, a mammoth. It became the world's first blockbuster exhibit and set off a wave of mammoth fever. The town of Cheshire, Massachusetts, produced a 1,230-pound mammoth cheese, a Philadelphia baker produced a mammoth bread, and the newspapers reported on a mammoth parsnip, a mammoth peach tree, and a mammoth eater, who swallowed 42 eggs in 10 minutes. Peel also managed to piece together a second mastodon out of additional bones found in Newburgh and nearby towns in the Hudson Valley. After a celebratory dinner held underneath the animal's capacious ribcage, he dispatched this second skeleton to Europe with two of his sons. The skeleton was exhibited for several months in London, during which time the younger Peels decided that the animal's tusks must have pointed downward, like a walrus's. Their plan was to take the skeleton on to Paris and sell it to Cuvier. But while they were still in London, war broke out between Britain and France, making travel between the countries impossible. Cuvier finally gave the mastodont its name in a paper published in Paris in 1806. The peculiar designation comes from the Greek meaning breast tooth. The knobby protuberances on the animal's molars apparently reminded him of nipples. By this point, the animal had already received a scientific name from a German naturalist. Unfortunately, this name, Mammut americanum, has perpetuated the confusion between mastodons and mammoths. Despite the ongoing hostilities between the British and the French, Cuvier managed to obtain detailed drawings of the skeleton Peel's sons had taken to London, and these gave him a much better picture of the animal's anatomy. He realized that the mastodon was far more distant from modern elephants than the mammoth, and assigned it to a new genus. Today, mastodons are given not only their own genus, but their own family. In addition to the American mastodon, Cuvier identified 4 other mastodon species, all equally strange to the earth today. Peel didn't learn of Cuvier's new name until 1809, and when he did, he immediately seized on it. He wrote to Jefferson proposing a christening for the mastodon skeleton in his Philadelphia museum. Jefferson was lukewarm about the name Cuvier had come up with. "It may be as good as any other," he sniffed, and didn't deign to respond to the idea of a christening. In 1812, Cuvier published a 4-volume compendium of his work on fossil animals, Recherches sur les ossements fossiles des quadrupèdes. Before he'd begun his researches, there had been, depending upon who was doing the counting, 0 or 1 extinct vertebrate. Thanks for the most part to his own efforts, there were now 49. As Cuvier's list grew, so too did his renown. Few naturalists dared to announce their findings in public until he had vetted them. "Is not Cuvier the greatest poet of our century?" Honoré de Balzac would ask. "Our immortal naturalist has reconstructed worlds from a whitened bone, rebuilt, like Cadmus, cities from a tooth." Cuvier was honored by Napoleon and, once the Napoleonic Wars finally ended, was invited to Britain, where he was presented at court. The English were eager converts to Cuvier's project. In the early years of the 19th century, fossil collecting became so popular among the upper classes that a whole new vocation sprung up. A fossilist was someone who made a living hunting up specimens for wealthy patrons. The same year Cuvier published his Recherches, one such fossilist, a young woman named Mary Anning, discovered a particularly outlandish specimen. The creature's skull, found in the limestone cliffs of Dorset, was nearly 4 feet long, with a jaw shaped like a pair of needle-nose pliers. Its eye sockets, peculiarly large, were covered with bony plates. The fossil ended up in London at the Egyptian Hall, a privately owned museum not unlike Peel's. It was put on exhibit as a fish, and then as a relative of a platypus, before being recognized as a new kind of reptile, an ichthyosaur, or fish lizard. A few years later, other specimens collected by Anning yielded pieces of another, even wilder creature, dubbed a plesiosaur, or almost lizard. Oxford's first professor of geology, the Reverend William Buckland, described the plesiosaur as having the head of a lizard, joined to a neck resembling the body of a serpent, the ribs of a chameleon, and the paddles of a whale. Apprised of the find, Cuvier found the account of the plesiosaur so outrageous that he questioned whether the specimens had been doctored. When Anning uncovered another, nearly complete plesiosaur fossil, he was once again quickly informed of the finding, at which point he had to acknowledge that he'd been wrong. "One shouldn't anticipate anything more monstrous to emerge," he wrote to one of his English correspondents. During Cuvier's visit to England, he went to visit Oxford, where Buckland showed him yet another astonishing fossil. An enormous jaw, with one curved tooth sticking up out of it like a scimitar. Cuvier identified this animal, too, as some sort of lizard. The jaw would, a few decades later, be recognized as belonging to a dinosaur. The study of stratigraphy was at this point in its infancy, but it was already understood that different layers of rocks had been formed during different periods. The plesiosaur, the ichthyosaur, and the as yet unnamed dinosaur had all been found in limestone deposits that were attributed to what was then called the secondary and is now known as the Mesozoic era. So too had the pterodactyl and the Maastricht animal. This pattern led Cuvier to another extraordinary insight about the history of life. It had a direction. Lost species whose remains could be found near the surface of Earth, like mastodons and cave bears, belonged to orders of creatures still alive. Dig back farther, and one found creatures, like the animal from Montmartre, that had no obvious modern counterparts. Keep digging, and mammals disappeared altogether from the fossil record. Eventually, one reached a world not just previous to ours, but a world previous to that, dominated by giant reptiles. Cuvier's ideas about this history of life, that it was long, mutable, and full of fantastic creatures that no longer existed, would seem to have made him a natural advocate for evolution. But Cuvier opposed the concept of evolution, or transformisme, as it was known in Paris at the time, and he tried, generally it seems successfully, to humiliate any colleagues who advanced the theory. Curiously, it was the very same skills that led him to discover extinction that made evolution seem to him so preposterous, an affair as unlikely as levitation. As Cuvier liked to point out, he put his faith in anatomy. This was what had allowed him to distinguish the bones of a mammoth from those of an elephant, and to recognize as a giant salamander what others took to be a man. At the heart of his understanding of anatomy was a notion he termed correlation of parts. By this he meant that the components of an animal all fit together and are optimally designed for its particular way of life. Thus, for example, a carnivore will have an intestinal system suited to digesting flesh. At the same time, its jaws will be constructed for devouring prey, the claws for seizing and tearing it, the teeth for cutting and dividing its flesh, the entire system of its locomotive organs for pursuing and catching it, its sense organs for detecting it from afar. Conversely, an animal with hooves must necessarily be an herbivore, since it has no means of seizing prey. It will have teeth with a flat crown to grind seeds and grasses, and a jaw capable of lateral motion. Were any one of these parts to be altered, the functional integrity of the whole would be destroyed. An animal that was born with, say, teeth or sense organs that were somehow different from its parents would not be able to survive, let alone give rise to a whole new kind of creature. In Cuvier's day, the most prominent proponent of transformisme was his senior colleague at the Museum of Natural History, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. According to Lamarck, there was a force, the power of life, that pushed organisms to become increasingly complex. At the same time, animals and also plants often had to cope with changes in their environment. They did so by adjusting their habits. These new habits, in turn, produced physical modifications that were then passed down to their offspring. Birds that sought prey in lakes spread out their toes when they hit the water, and in this way eventually developed webbed feet and became ducks. Moles, having moved underground, stopped using their sight, and so over generations their eyes became small and weak. Lamarck, for his part, adamantly opposed Cuvier's idea of extinction. There was no process he could imagine capable of wiping an organism out entirely. Interestingly, the only exception he entertained was humanity, which, Lamarck allowed, might be able to exterminate certain large and slow-to-reproduce animals. What Cuvier interpreted as espèces perdues, Lamarck claimed were simply those that had been most completely transformed. The notion that animals could change their body types when convenient, Cuvier found absurd. He lampooned the idea that ducks by dint of diving became pikes, pikes by dint of happening upon dry land changed into ducks, hens searching for their food at the water's edge and striving not to get their thighs wet, succeeded so well in elongating their legs that they became herons or storks. He discovered what was, to his mind at least, definitive proof against transformisme in a collection of mummies. When Napoleon had invaded Egypt, the French had, as usual, seized whatever interested them. Among the crates of loot shipped back to Paris was an embalmed cat. Cuvier examined the mummy, looking for signs of transformation. He found none. The ancient Egyptian cat was, anatomically speaking, indistinguishable from a Parisian alley cat. This proved that species were fixed. Lamarck objected that the few thousand years that had elapsed since the Egyptian cat had been embalmed represented an infinitely small duration relative to the vastness of time. I know that some naturalists rely a lot on the thousands of centuries that they pile up with a stroke of the pen, Cuvier responded dismissively. Eventually, Cuvier would be called upon to compose a eulogy for Lamarck, which he did very much in the spirit of burying rather than praising. Lamarck, according to Cuvier, was a fantasist. Like the enchanted palaces of our old romances, his theories were built on imaginary foundations, so that while they might amuse the imagination of a poet, they could not for a moment bear the examination of anyone who has dissected a hand, a viscus, or even a feather. Having dismissed transformisme, Cuvier was left with a gaping hole. He had no account of how new organisms could appear, nor any explanation of how the world could have come to be populated by different groups of animals at different times. This doesn't seem to have bothered him. His interest, after all, was not in the origin of species, but in their demise. The very first time he spoke about the subject, Cuvier intimated that he knew the driving force behind extinction, if not the exact mechanism. In his lecture on The Species of Elephants, Both Living and Fossil, he proposed that the mastodon, the mammoth, and the megatherium had all been wiped out by some kind of catastrophe. Cuvier hesitated to speculate about the precise nature of this calamity. It is not for us to involve ourselves in the vast field of conjectures that these questions open up, he said. But he seems to have believed at that point that one disaster would have sufficed. Later, as his list of extinct species grew, his position changed. There had, he decided, been multiple cataclysms. Life on Earth has often been disturbed by terrible events, he wrote. Living organisms without number have been the victims of these catastrophes. Like his view of transformisme, Cuvier's belief in cataclysm fit with, indeed could be said to follow from, his convictions about anatomy. Since animals were functional units, ideally suited to their circumstances, there was no reason why, in the ordinary course of events, they should die out. Not even the most devastating events known to occur in the contemporary world, volcanic eruptions, say, or forest fires, were sufficient to explain extinction. Confronted with such changes, organisms simply moved on and survived. The changes that had caused extinctions must therefore have been of a much greater magnitude, so great that animals had been unable to cope with them. That such extreme events had never been observed by him or any other naturalist was another indication of nature's mutability. In the past, it had operated differently, more intensely and more savagely than it did at present. The thread of operations is broken, Cuvier wrote. Nature has changed course, and none of the agents she employs today would have been sufficient to produce her former works. Cuvier spent several years studying the rock formations around Paris. Together with a friend, he produced the first stratigraphic map of the Paris Basin, and here, too, he saw signs of cataclysmic change. The rocks showed that the region had, at various points, been submerged. The shifts from one environment to the other, from marine to terrestrial, or, at some points, from marine to fresh water, had, Cuvier decided, not been slow at all. Rather, they had been brought about by sudden revolutions on the surface of the Earth. The most recent of these revolutions must have occurred relatively recently, for traces of it were still everywhere apparent. This event, Cuvier believed, lay just beyond the edge of recorded history. He observed that many ancient myths and texts, including the Old Testament, allude to some sort of crisis, usually a deluge, that preceded the present order. Cuvier's ideas about a globe racked periodically by cataclysm proved very nearly as influential as his original discoveries. His major essay on the subject, which was published in French in 1812, was almost immediately reprinted in English and exported to America. It also appeared in German, Swedish, Italian, Russian, and Czech. But a good deal was lost, or at least misinterpreted, in translation. Cuvier's essay was pointedly secular. He cited the Bible as one of many old and not entirely reliable works, alongside the Hindu Vedas and the Shujing. This sort of ecumenicalism was unacceptable to the Anglican clergy, who made up the faculty at institutions like Oxford, and when the essay was translated into English, it was construed by Buckland and others as offering proof of Noah's flood. The empirical grounds of Cuvier's theory have, by now, largely been disproved. The physical evidence that convinced him of a revolution just prior to recorded history, and that the English interpreted as proof of the deluge, was, in reality, debris left behind by the last glaciation. The stratigraphy of the Paris Basin reflects not sudden eruptions of water, but rather gradual changes in sea level and the effects of plate tectonics. On all these matters, Cuvier was, we now know, wrong. At the same time, some of Cuvier's most wild-sounding claims have turned out to be surprisingly accurate. Life on Earth has been disturbed by terrible events, and organisms without number have been their victims. Such events cannot be explained by the forces or agents at work in the present. Nature does, on occasion, change course, and at such moments, it is as if the thread of operations has been broken. Meanwhile, as far as the American mastodon is concerned, Cuvier was to an almost uncanny extent correct. He decided that the beast had been wiped out 5 or 6,000 years ago, in the same revolution that had killed off the mammoth and the megatherium. In fact, the American mastodon vanished around 13,000 years ago. Its demise was part of a wave of disappearances that has come to be known as the megafauna extinction. This wave coincided with the spread of modern humans, and increasingly is understood to have been a result of it. In this sense, the crisis Cuvier discerned just beyond the edge of recorded history was us. Chapter 3. The Original Penguin. Pinguinus impennis. The word catastrophist was coined in 1832 by William Whewell, one of the first presidents of the Geological Society of London, who also bequeathed to English anode, cathode, ion, and scientist. Although the term would later pick up pejorative associations, which stuck to it like burrs, this was not Whewell's intention. When he proposed it, Whewell made it clear that he considered himself a catastrophist, and that most of the other scientists he knew were catastrophists too. Indeed, there was really only one person he was acquainted with whom the label did not fit, and that was an up-and-coming young geologist named Charles Lyell. For Lyell, Whewell came up with yet another neologism. He called him a uniformitarian. Lyell had grown up in the south of England, in the sort of world familiar to fans of Jane Austen. He'd then attended Oxford and trained to become a barrister. Failing eyesight made it difficult for him to practice law, so he turned to the natural sciences instead. As a young man, Lyell made several trips to the continent and became friendly with Cuvier, at whose house he dined often. He found the older man to be personally very obliging. Cuvier allowed him to make casts of several famous fossils to take back with him to England. But Cuvier's vision of Earth history, Lyell regarded as thoroughly unpersuasive. When Lyell looked, admittedly myopically, at the rock outcroppings of the British countryside, or at the strata of the Paris Basin, or at the volcanic islands near Naples, he saw no evidence of cataclysm. In fact, quite the reverse. He thought it unscientific, or as he put it, unphilosophical, to imagine that change in the world had ever occurred for different reasons, or at different rates than it did in the present day. According to Lyell, every feature of the landscape was the result of very gradual processes operating over countless millennia. Processes like sedimentation, erosion, and volcanism, which were all still readily observable. For generations of geology students, Lyell's thesis would be summed up as, "The present is the key to the past." As far as extinction was concerned, this too, according to Lyell, occurred at a very slow pace. So slow that, at any given time, in any given place, it would not be surprising were it to go unnoticed. The fossil evidence, which seemed to suggest that species had at various points died out en masse, was a sign that the record was unreliable. Even the idea that the history of life had a direction to it, first reptiles, then mammals, was mistaken, another faulty inference drawn from inadequate data. All manner of organisms had existed in all eras. And those that had apparently vanished for good could, under the right circumstances, pop up again. Thus the huge iguanodon might reappear in the woods, and the ichthyosaur in the sea, while the pterodactyl might flit again through umbrageous groves of tree ferns. "It is clear," Lyell wrote, "that there is no foundation in geological facts for the popular theory of the successive development of the animal and vegetable world." Lyell published his ideas in three thick volumes: Principles of Geology, B. being an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. The work was aimed at a general audience, which embraced it enthusiastically. A first print run of 4,500 copies quickly sold out, and a second run of 9,000 was ordered up. In a letter to his fiancée, Lyle boasted that this represented at least 10 times as many books as any other English geologist had ever sold. Lyle became something of a celebrity, the Steven Pinker of his generation, and when he spoke in Boston, more than 4,000 people tried to get tickets. For the sake of clarity and a good read, Lyle had caricatured his opponents, making them sound a great deal more unphilosophical than they actually were. They returned the favor. A British geologist named Henry de la Beche, who had a knack for drawing, poked fun at Lyle's ideas about eternal return. He produced a cartoon showing Lyle in the form of a nearsighted ichthyosaur, pointing to a human skull and lecturing to a group of giant reptiles. "You will at once perceive," Professor Ichthyosaurus tells his pupils in the caption, "that the skull before us belonged to some of the lower order of animals. The teeth are very insignificant, the power of the jaws trifling, and altogether it seems wonderful how the creature could have procured food." De la Beche called the sketch "awful changes." Among the readers who snapped up the principles was Charles Darwin. 22 years old and fresh out of Cambridge, Darwin had been invited to serve as a sort of gentleman's companion to the captain of the HMS Beagle, Robert Fitzroy. The ship was headed to South America to survey the coast and resolve various mapping discrepancies that hindered navigation. The Admiralty was particularly interested in finding the best approach to the Falkland Islands, which the British had recently assumed control of. The voyage, which would last until Darwin was 27, would take him from Plymouth to Montevideo, through the Strait of Magellan, up to the Galapagos Islands, across the South Pacific to Tahiti, on to New Zealand, Australia, and Tasmania, across the Indian Ocean to Mauritius, around the Cape of Good Hope, and back again to South America. In the popular imagination, the journey is usually seen as the time when Darwin, encountering a wild assortment of giant tortoises, seafaring lizards, and finches with beaks of every imaginable shape and size, discovered natural selection. In fact, Darwin developed his theory only after his return to England, when other naturalists sorted out the jumble of specimens he had shipped back. It would be more accurate to describe the voyage of the Beagle as the period when Darwin discovered Lyle. Shortly before the ship's departure, Fitzroy presented Darwin with a copy of Volume 1 of The Principles. Although he was horribly seasick on the first leg of the journey, as he was on many subsequent legs, Darwin reported that he read Lyle attentively as the ship headed south. The Beagle made its first stop at St. Iago, now Santiago, in the Cape Verde Islands, and Darwin, eager to put his new knowledge to work, spent several days collecting specimens from its rocky cliffs. One of Lyle's central claims was that some areas of the earth were gradually rising, just as others were gradually subsiding. Lyle further contended that these phenomena were always in balance, so as to preserve the uniformity of the general relations of the land and sea. St. Iago seemed to prove his point. The island was clearly volcanic in origin, but it had several curious features, including a ribbon of white limestone halfway up the dark cliffs. The only way to explain these features, Darwin concluded, was as evidence of uplift. "The very first place, which I geologized, convinced me of the infinite superiority of Lyle's views," he would later write. So taken was Darwin with Volume 1 of The Principles that he had Volume 2 shipped to him for pickup at Montevideo. Volume 3, it seems, caught up with him in the Falklands. While the Beagle was sailing along the west coast of South America, Darwin spent several months exploring Chile. He was resting after a hike one afternoon near the town of Valdivia when the ground beneath him began to wobble as if made of jelly. 1 second of time conveys to the mind a strange idea of insecurity which hours of reflection could never create, he wrote. Several days after the earthquake, arriving in Concepcion, Darwin found the entire city had been reduced to rubble. It is absolutely true. There is not one house left habitable, he reported. The scene was the most awful yet interesting spectacle he'd ever witnessed. A series of surveying measurements that Fitzroy took around Concepcion's harbor showed that the quake had elevated the beach by nearly 8 feet. Once again, Lyell's principles appeared to be rather spectacularly confirmed. Given enough time, Lyell argued, repeated quakes could raise an entire mountain chain many thousands of feet high. The more Darwin explored the world, the more Lyellian it seemed to him to be. Outside the port of Valparaiso, he found deposits of marine shells far above sea level. These he took to be the result of many episodes of elevation like the one he'd just witnessed. I have always thought that the great merit of the principles was that it altered the whole tone of one's mind, he would later write. While in Chile, Darwin also discovered a new and rather remarkable species of frog, which became known as the Chile Darwin's frog. Males of the species incubated their tadpoles in their vocal sacs. Recent searches have failed to turn up any Chile Darwin's frogs, and the species is now believed to be extinct. Toward the end of the Beagle's voyage, Darwin encountered coral reefs. These provided him with his first major breakthrough, a startling idea that would ease his entree into London's scientific circles. Darwin saw that the key to understanding coral reefs was the interplay between biology and geology. If a reef formed around an island or along a continental margin that was slowly sinking, the corals, by growing slowly upward, could maintain their position relative to the water. Gradually, as the land subsided, the corals would form a barrier reef. If, eventually, the land sank away entirely, the reef would form an atoll. Darwin's account went beyond, and to a certain extent, contradicted Lyell's. The older man had hypothesized that reefs grew from the rims of submerged volcanoes. But Darwin's ideas were so fundamentally Lyellian in nature that when, upon his return to England, Darwin presented them to Lyell, the latter was delighted. As the historian of science Martin Rudwick has put it, Lyell recognized that Darwin had out-Lyelled him. One biographer summed up Lyell's influence on Darwin as follows. Without Lyell, there would have been no Darwin. Darwin himself, after publishing his account of the voyage of the Beagle, and also a volume on coral reefs, wrote, I always feel as if my books came half out of Lyell's brains. Lyell, who saw change occurring always and everywhere in the world around him, drew the line at life. That a species of plant or animal might over time give rise to a new one, he found unthinkable, and he devoted much of the second volume of The Principles to attacking the idea, at one point citing Cuvier's mummified cat experiment in support of his objections. Lyell's adamant opposition to transmutation, as it was known in London, is almost as puzzling as Cuvier's. New species, Lyell realized, regularly appeared in the fossil record. But how they originated was an issue he never really addressed, except to say that probably each one had begun with a single pair or individual, where an individual was sufficient, and multiplied and spread out from there. This process, which seemed to depend on divine or at least occult intervention, was clearly at odds with the precepts he had laid out for geology. Indeed, as one commentator observed, it seemed to require